Welcome back to Ghosts of Arlington, and thank you for joining me for episode 89, A Marine in the European Theater of Operation, part 2. Last week, we were introduced to Peter Ortiz, a young man looking for adventure who turned to the French Foreign Legion to scratch that itch. He served in the Legion for more than 4 years, fighting in Morocco and earning many medals from France in the process. He moved to Hollywood after his service in the Legion, but only enjoyed civilian life for 2 years before Germany invaded Poland. He rushed back to Europe, re-enlisted in the Legion, and was fighting in France when it fell to the Nazis. He spent 15 months in a POW camp before escaping and making his way back to the U.S. and almost immediately joining the U.S. Marine Corps. He was shipped off to Northern Africa and began working for the Office of Strategic Services before suffering a serious hand wound that forced him to return to the States to convalesce. As soon as he was well, he went looking for his next set of orders, and the OSS was all too happy to put him back to work, which is where our story picks up now. When Ortiz fully recovered, he was still in Washington, D.C., and was sent to the Congressional Country Club to begin training for his next assignment as a member of the multinational Jedburghs. Operation Jedburgh consisted of various three-man teams with members selected from the British SOE, U.S. OSS, the Free French Central Bureau of Intelligence and Operations, and the Dutch and Belgian armies in exile who would parachute into occupied France nearly 6 months ahead of the D-Day invasion to commit acts of sabotage and guerrilla warfare while leading local resistance forces in action against the Germans. By the end of December 1943, Ortiz was on his way to the UK to finish his Jedburgh training and to prepare for the invasion of Hitler's Fortress Europa. On January 6, 1944, now Captain Ortiz, British Colonel H.H.A. Thackwhite, and French resistance fighter André Foucault, regarded as the best radio operator in the OSS, jumped well behind the Normandy invasion beaches in the vicinity of the French Alps in Operation Union 1. Union 1's mission was to assess the military capabilities of the Maquis, aka the French Resistance, in the region and assist the organization and supply of those units. After landing, Thackwhite and Ortiz changed from their standard-issue civilian jump clothes into their military uniforms, becoming the first Allied officers to appear in uniform in occupied France since 1940. When Ortiz donned his uniform, it was his Marine Corps service uniform with all its badges and French combat and campaign ribbons to better impress the French fighters they planned to meet. But his intention didn't stop with just impressing the Maquis. As Thackwhite later wrote, Ortiz, who knew no fear, did not hesitate to wear his U.S. Marine captain's uniform in town and country alike. This cheered the French but alerted the Germans, and the mission was constantly on the move. For his part, Ortiz thought that Thackwhite's statement, "he knew no fear," was ridiculous. He knew fear, he had been severely wounded twice, but he still had a job to do, and in his mind, wearing the uniform was all about bolstering their French allies. Over the next several months, what the Union 1 team discovered was that there were many French willing to fight in the resistance, but they had little means to do so. These Maquis cells needed everything from arms and ammunition to radios, money, and blankets, every imaginable supply for military operations. Ortiz and his two comrades organized base camps and hospitals, and arranged for families of resistance members to receive stipends, which helped boost morale even more. When weapons and explosives arrived, the team trained the fighters how to use them. Ortiz helped lead sabotage missions and was instrumental in helping downed Allied pilots evade the Germans and safely escape to neutral Spain. His role in rescuing four British officers resulted in his committing a spectacular act of theft that infuriated the Gestapo and led him to ultimately receive the Order of the British Empire. According to his OBE citation, "For 4 months, this officer assisted in the organization of the Maquis in a most difficult region, where members were in constant danger of attack. He ran great risks in looking after four Royal Air Force officers who had been brought down in the neighborhood, and accompanied them to the Spanish border at the Pyrenees. In the course of his efforts to obtain the release of these officers, he raided a German garage and took 10 Gestapo vehicles, which he used frequently. He procured a Gestapo pass for his own use, in spite of the fact that he was well known by the enemy." It would seem, dear listener, that he was putting his German language skills to good use. It was also during this period that Ortiz, who, as I just alluded to, had garnered a notorious reputation with the Germans, decided to one-up even himself during a Hollywood-style confrontation with a German officer that, despite corroborating eyewitness accounts, seems too unbelievable to be true. Though some details of the event differ, the gist is, a group of officers from the German 157th Division, which had previously suffered at the hands of Ortiz and the resistance, were in a bar that Ortiz occasionally visited and were loudly cursing the, quote, "tall American Marine, the Allies, President Franklin Roosevelt, and the U.S. Marine Corps," among others. Ortiz, who was sitting nearby dressed in civilian clothes, had heard enough. He left, went to his safe house, put on his Marine uniform, and two 1911 pistols, both of which he hid under a raincoat. He then returned to the bar and approached the German officers. Ortiz ordered a round of drinks, took off his raincoat, revealing the uniform complete with badges and ribbons, and pointed the pistols at the Germans. "A toast to the President of the United States," he said. After the stunned officers downed their drinks, he ordered another round, this time making them drink a toast to the United States Marine Corps. Some accounts have him shooting the officers. By Ortiz's own account, he escaped without shooting anyone because, by letting them live, the story of his action would boost his legend even more. But this wasn't about pride. He was trying to raise Maquis morale while simultaneously eroding German morale. In late May 1944, just before D-Day, this Union 1 team was exfiltrated back to England for further assignment. While awaiting new orders, Ortiz was decorated with the first of his two Navy Crosses, the Valor Award just below the Medal of Honor. He was also promoted to Major. Major Ortiz returned to France on August 1, 1944, about 2 months after D-Day, in command of Union 2. He was now commanding a new type of OSS unit, an operational group. This was a heavily armed contingent meant to link up with and supply the local resistance fighters, and were tasked with direct action against the Germans with the resistance help. They were not only to conduct sabotage, but were also to seize key installations to prevent retreating Germans from destroying them. And this time, team members were always in uniform. Ortiz's 7-man military team consisted of his executive officer, Army Air Corps Captain Francis Coolidge, Marine Gunnery Sergeant Robert LaSalle, 4 additional Marine sergeants, and a free French officer who carried false papers identifying him as a Marine. They were dropped into the Haute Savoy region of France in a daytime jump along with 864 containers of supplies for the resistance in that area. The mission began badly when the steel parachute cable of Sergeant Charles Perry snapped, and he was killed when he hit the drop zone. His comrades buried Perry with full military honors. Things only went downhill from there. Barely a week after landing, Ortiz and his team found themselves being pursued by more than 100 Germans, far from their operational base, surrounded by unfamiliar mountain terrain. The Germans caught up with the team in a village called Centrone, and a house-to-house gunfight ensued. The Marines held their own for a while, but escape seemed unlikely. Thinking about recent German reprisals against French villagers who were caught with the Marquis or the Jedburghs, Ortiz conferred with his men and they decided to surrender. Ortiz called out his desire to parley in English, French, and German, and then, unarmed and ignoring German gunfire, he began boldly walking toward German lines. When the firing eventually stopped, he made his proposal to surrender if the villagers would be left in peace to the German commander. For his part, the German commander, who thought he was facing at least a company-sized element, agreed to the terms and was dumbstruck when he realized it was just a handful of Marines who had held off his battalion. Funny enough, despite speaking no English, the Germans accepted the story that the team's free French officer was an American Marine and let him remain with the other new prisoners. During their trip to the prison, Ortiz talked a lot with the German commander, who revealed so much knowledge about Ortiz and his mission that Ortiz became certain that there was a spy among the Maquis with whom he was training and fighting. Despite multiple escape attempts, Ortiz spent the rest of the war as a POW. As Allied forces were approaching his camp, and the Germans were quickly trying to move the prisoners, he was finally able to slip away with 3 other POWs, and the Germans marched the other prisoners away. But the Allied advance was slower than expected. Ortiz later reported, "We spent 10 days hiding, roving at night, blundering into enemy positions, hoping to find our way to British lines. Luck was with us. Once we were discovered but managed to get away, and several other times we narrowly escaped detection. By the 7th night, we had returned near our camp. I made a reconnaissance of the place. There seemed to be only a token guard, and prisoners of war seemed to have assumed virtual control of the compounds." By this time, Ortiz and his escapees were in bad shape. On the 10th day, the 4 men decided it might be better to live in their old huts than to starve to death outside. They walked back into the camp, no commotion was raised by the guards, and the remaining POWs gave them a rousing welcome. Among those celebrating Ortiz's return were 3 of his Union 2 teammates. The camp was liberated by the British 7th Guards Armor Division 2 days later. The 4 Union 2 guys and another OSS officer who had been in the camp asked to join the British to keep fighting the Germans. Their request was denied. After his liberation, Ortiz was sent to London, awarded a 2nd Navy Cross for his service in Union 2 and his leadership as the senior U.S. POW at his camp. The French government also awarded him the Legion of Honor, its highest award for valor. Ortiz had volunteered to be transferred to the Pacific, but Japan surrendered before his orders arrived. In 1946, he was discharged from active duty and returned to California and civilian life in the movie industry. He restarted his career as a technical advisor, but his Clark Gable good looks also landed him no fewer than 27 small on-screen acting parts, though most were uncredited. He was a good friend with legendary Western director and fellow OSS veteran John Ford, who put him in a number of his movies, including two with John Wayne, Rio Grande and The Wings of Eagles. Some of his other credits include She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, 12 O'Clock High, and Flying Leathernecks. Unfortunately, his movie career never took off, and he was mostly relegated to bit parts and walk-ons in less acclaimed films, like the small role he had as a corporal in Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion. In the words of his son, Ortiz was an awful actor, but had great fun appearing in movies. Two movies loosely based on his life were released, 1947's 13 Rue Madeleine, starring James Cagney, and 1952's Operation Secret, starring Cornel Wilde. He thought that 13 Rue Madeleine, which he had consulted on and had a small part in, was all right as a movie, but not as a life story. He was more blunt about Operation Secret. Though he had been told he would help with the screenplay, Ortiz was never consulted and was not too happy with the end results. He also had a bit part in this one, but after seeing the complete film, his only comment was, "Well, that was disappointing." He remained in the Marine Corps Reserve, reaching the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He was offered the command of a reserve tank battalion in San Diego, but had to turn it down because his commitments in Hollywood kept him quite busy. In April 1954, he wrote a letter to the Commandant of the Marine Corps, volunteering to return to active duty to serve as a Marine observer in Indochina, where French forces were being forced out of their colony that would go on to be called Vietnam. The Marine Corps was unable to accept Ortiz's offer because, quote, "current military policies will not permit the assignment requested." Ortiz retired in March 1955 and was promoted to colonel on the retired list for having been decorated in combat. I've already mentioned several of his awards, but we'll reiterate a few now because his two Navy Crosses, Legion of Merit with V for Valor, two Purple Hearts, Order of the British Empire, French Legion of Honor, French Military Medal, and two French Croix de Guerre, among others, made him the most highly decorated member of the OSS. On May 16, 1988, Marine Corps Colonel Pierre Julien Peter Ortiz died in Prescott, Arizona after a battle with cancer. He is buried at Arlington National Cemetery in Section 59, Grave 1269. In addition to a Marine Corps honor guard, the funeral was attended by representatives from the British and French governments, two surviving members of his Union 2 team, and members of his family, including his son, Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Ortiz Jr. The first time I learned about Colonel Ortiz was during one of my many trips to the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Quantico, Virginia. As I mentioned in last week's opening, many people are familiar with the Marine Corps' island-hopping campaign in the Pacific, but few realize that a handful of Marines assigned to the OSS operated in Europe. The World War II gallery at the museum reflects this. It is large and tells the story of many gallant Marines who fought in the Pacific. But if you get a chance to visit, as you near the Sherman tank in that gallery, you will notice a glass case in the middle of the room. Unfortunately, it has been some time since I last visited the museum, and that particular case is not listed on the museum's website. One side of the case is dedicated to a Marine who I believe was a master sergeant who served in the OSS, and the other side is dedicated to Peter Ortiz, a fitting memorial to an amazing Marine. Before I sign off today, I have an admin announcement to make. Due to work travel, I will not be able to release a new episode next week, but hope to begin my series on William Donovan, the father of the OSS, in 2 weeks' time. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are pictures related to every episode on the website www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. You can help others learn about the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating and review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.